Hello and welcome back to New Books in Latino Studies. I'm David James Gonzalez, the host of the channel, and today I'm speaking with Natalia Molina, author of How Race is Made in America, Immigration, Citizenship, and the Historical Power of Racial Scripts, published by the University of California Press in 2014. Dr. Molina is an associate professor in the departments of history and urban studies at the University of California, San Diego, where she also holds the position of associate vice chancellor for faculty diversity and equity. Professor Molina's research and teaching interests focus on the intersections of race, gender, culture, and citizenship. She is the author of the award-winning book, Fit to be Citizens, Public Health and Race in Los Angeles, 1879 to 1939, which received the Norris and Carol Hunley Book Prize by the Pacific Coast branch of the American Historical Association. Among many other positions, awards, and accolades, Professor Molina is on the board of Cal Humanities and is a distinguished lecturer for the Organization of American Historians. Hello, Natalia, and welcome to New Books in Latino Studies.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. I'm pleased for you to be with us. And I was wondering if you would begin our discussion today by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Well, as you mentioned, my first book focused on Los Angeles. And part of that reason was one, because it focused on Mexicans and Mexican-Americans, and Los Angeles was the largest receiving city for those communities. But also because I'm from Los Angeles, from the Echo Park section of Los Angeles. And in my articles in the Pacific Historical Review that I published a couple years ago now, titled Examining Chicana-Chicana History Through a Relational Lens, I explained that growing up in Echo Park really had a large impact on me in terms of thinking about race relationally. It was a multi-ethnic, multi-racial area. There were Mexican immigrant families like my own. My best friend on one side of my house was Colleen Patricia, Irish-Mexican. My other good friend was Katie, who was working-class white. We had Vietnamese, Chinese immigrants, very few African-Americans. And it really got me thinking about always sort of trying to figure out why our experiences growing up were quite different. We experienced school differently, the kind of messages that we got at school, the kind of resources that were developed and directed towards us.
Mm-hmm.
And then I ended up going to school at UCLA. And there I took classes in history, a lot of Latin American history classes, and women's studies. And I think women's studies was one of the first places that I finally got this vocabulary to understand these race and gendered experiences that I had. And so I became hooked. You know, I think like many Chicanos, I had visions of being a doctor, or at least I was full family. If you're going to college, you should be a doctor or lawyer. But
right.
Once I started taking those history and women's studies classes, I really stuck with those. And the other thing I really liked about the women's studies classes at UCLA was that they were very much focused around intersectionality, around a serious interrogation of the intersectionality of race, class, gender, sexuality. And so you had women of color in literature class. You had women artists. You had, you know, women in social movements. And it was always seen from a relational perspective. And all this really shaped my work. I ended up going to graduate school at the University of Michigan. And at that point, I had to decide, was I going to do interdisciplinary program, like I had done as an undergrad with women's studies, or a disciplinary program, like I had also done as an undergraduate. And at that point, I decided to go the disciplinary route because at that point in time, it just seemed the easier route to get a job. And I don't think that's necessarily true anymore. What was great about history at Michigan was that it was very closely tied to the American Culture Program, which was run by George Sanchez at the time, who was my dissertation advisor, and as you know, is now at USC. So it was a really great experience.
Thank you for that background, and I always appreciate hearing how one comes to, you know, decide upon their, and particularly within academia, their disciplinary spine, if you will, or pursuit. And it makes me think of why I chose the historical discipline as well. And I wasn't too aware, getting my start in community college, that interdisciplinary programs like American studies programs even existed. I think community college is still very much structured in, you know, the disciplinary, you know, confines and what. But I eventually, I think I settled on history as well because I saw I could do a lot of things with it, you know, that I was interested in sociology and political science and all these other things. And I thought, you know, history seemed to be the one of the disciplines where you had all sorts of people having these conversations that are pulling from the literatures that I was interested in. So it's nice to hear that you seem to come to your interest in your focus as a historian, you know, in a kind of a similar way that you were able to identify a program that could allow you to, you know, combine a lot of interests. As you mentioned, intersectionality, you could see how what you'd experienced, you could actually study that pursuit. So thank you for that. About the book, can you tell us a little bit about how you decided to write How Race is Made in America?
Decide is a loose term to use here. You know, for your first book, as a historian, you know, history is a book discipline. So if you are a historian, if you get a job at a research university or a university that requires you to publish, and especially if publishing is a big part of that job, and you're a historian, you're supposed to publish a book in order to get tenure.
Right.
And oftentimes for history, that is your book is based on your dissertation.
Mm-hmm.
So for the first book, I had time off from, I didn't have a job yet. I was sometimes a teaching assistant but for the most part, I had time to do my research, in a sustained and focused way and writing in a more sustained and focused way.
Mm-hmm.
But for your second book, by then you have a job, you sometimes have a family, you have tenure, you have a lot of other responsibilities, board responsibilities, responsibilities with community organizations, that kind of thing, besides your teaching. And so that book I pursued in a less kind of sustained, focused way. I did a lot of research at the National Archives in Washington, D.C. National Archives in Washington, D.C. is kind of like the attic of America. It's where we keep all our memories. It's where we keep our stories. It's where we keep our histories. And when I was writing the first book, I did research there, and I remember coming across these sources, these historical sources that discussed, let's say, immigration, Mexican immigration in the 1910s, of Mexican field workers working, harvesting beets in Colorado, or picking cantaloupes in the Imperial Valley. And I remember reading the books that had use these sources that talked about Mexican immigrants. But what was different when you first saw the source, when I looked at the sources, was they weren't just talking about Mexicans. They were also talking about Asian immigrants. They were talking about the Japanese who owned those farms. Or they were talking about the Filipinos who were also hired to work alongside them. And I realized, like I did in my first book, that because much of what we... the way the disciplines are shaped, we talk about Chicano studies, Chicano history, African-American history, Asian-American history, and we tend to look at these groups separately.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the way we experience life. You know, we can think of our own lives that, you know, even if you live in a somewhat segregated neighborhood, and even if you went to a somewhat segregated school, probably your parents didn't work in a segregated workplace, or somebody traveled outside the neighborhood, or you went to concert somewhere else. At some point, you were, you know, interacting with different people. And it's the same thing when you look at the sources. So that became kind of the kernel for the book.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that really drove the book, now the first of trying to write a book, was just questions. And I've always just simply been fascinated by this different trajectory that Mexicans experienced in terms of race and assimilation and Americanization to, say, Irish immigrants.
Right.
So if you study European immigration, if you study immigration, especially if you studied it 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and many people are kind of still are under this illusion that immigrants come to the U.S., they work hard, they learn English, they send their kids to American schools, they learning, you know, they become Christian maybe, and by, you know, two or three generations, they're Americanized. Mm-hmm. And that's the way a lot of the earlier literature on immigration went. But when the Chicano movement happened, the Black Power movement, these social movements of the 1960s happened, and we started studying these groups in school in more of the 70s, 80s, and definitely by the 90s, we realized that those groups didn't have quite the same assimilation patterns.
Right.
So it's not a surprise that when somebody who's Mexican, even if the third, fourth generation, will tell you, people sometimes will ask me where I'm from. No, where I'm really from.
Right.
Or how did you learn to speak English? There's always a way that they're not quite American. Mm-hmm. And I was always curious how that happened, especially because if you go back to the 1924 Immigration Act, that act put Asians on quotas, and so mm-hmm. they weren't even allowed to immigrate to the U.S. Or naturalize, become citizens. Although now we now have the stereotype of Asians as minorities.
Right.
Europeans were the ones who were put on this quota system, though in a kind of hierarchy. And so Irish, Greeks, they were, you know, for example, were low on, Italians were low on that hierarchy. And how many people of that immigrant background are thought of as white? Mexicans weren't put on those quotas. So how is it that Mexicans are still often thought of as not quite American?
Right.
And the point of the book was to try to answer that, but because I also had this relational lens, this way of thinking about, well, who else was around Mexicans and how did their presence affect the way that we think about Mexicans?
Mm-hmm.
How did that happen? So it was kind of a way of asking a question and using that way of thinking about race relationally as a lens to answer it.
Right. Well, and that's what one of the things that really attracted me to the book is the title itself, How Race is Made in America, because particularly when I started looking at it and knowing of your work beforehand, I thought it was it was rather provocative, because when I tend to think, and I think maybe perhaps when a lot of people tend to think about the history of race or racism, or whatever that is, when they hear the word race in America, as you mentioned earlier, they think more along that black-white paradigm. And so initially seeing a book that was here, you know, going to be essentially talking about immigration and Mexican Americans and some other groups, I thought, wow, you know, I'm interested to see how this book is going to go and where it's going to take this discussion. And you mentioned the relational nature of both. Well, first of all, your experiences growing up with various with people from various ethno and cultural and racial backgrounds. You introduce a concept in the book that of racial scripts that helps you to emphasize this racial lens that you're talking about. Can you explain the concept of racial scripts a little bit more? We're going to talk about it more as we get through some examples, but can you give us just maybe a sample understanding before we get into the book itself? About why it's necessary for you, why you coded that word, and then why it's necessary again.
Yes, of course. So the central goal of the book is to get us to see these connections among racialized groups. And I'll just clarify, because you, I think right now, like ethno-racial and cultural, and I use racialized, and somebody else will use ethnic and race. And so different schools of thought will use different terms, but we're all trying to mean the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
We're trying to get at race and ethnicity. And because I like to always think about, you know, as a historian, how race and ethnicity change over time, how it's a constructed category. I use the term racialized to show it's this kind of dynamic process.
Right.
But to better understand how race operates relationally, I really like the use of the term racial scripts. And I see it operating in three main ways. And so the first is that racial scripts highlight how racial groups are acted upon. So kind of that, you know, what we, in history we call that top-down action, how groups are acted upon by a range of principles. And these can be anybody from institutional actors to ordinary citizens. So this might be judges or lawmakers, sheriffs, border patrol agents, public health officials, employers, co-workers, or even your neighbors. And I mm-hmm. write about all these people in the book.
Right.
These are all people that are writing into the INS, Immigration and Naturalization Service, saying, hey, what about my neighbor? Are they Mexican? Are they white? Can they be a citizen? Because they say they're Mexican. They're not black. but they're kind of brown. And, you know, it's this way that we employ all these things to think about race.
Mm-hmm.
And then I discussed racial scripts endure as both cultural representations and other built-in structures and practices. And this is where I'm getting kind of academic-y, so I want to mm-hmm. make sure that I don't lose any of your listeners. And so, you know, for structural things, we often think about structure as kind of being the scaffolding of
right.
things like laws and customs, policies, while cultural representations are more about the ways in which we see and experience race, as well as how we talk about it, the discourse around it. So I used the 1924 Immigration Act as an example. That's a structural part of race. Because
mm-hmm.
those lawmakers passed it, and then they got voted out of office, they eventually died, but that law stayed in place. So whether or not the group of people that occupied those offices believed that we should ban Asians and continue to keep European immigrants on a quota, they had to abide by that. And so that's the structural part.
Mm-hmm.
The cultural representation part of how we think about race, those are more like the images that we have, that we talk about it. Those kind of sometimes are stereotypes, but they're often representations that rely on assumptions, conscious or not.
Mm-hmm.
The way that we start to think about race is very common sense, very common place. Like, oh yeah, that's just the way it's always been. Although, you know, and I'll give you examples throughout the book, from the book as we speak, we'll see that these ideas about race change over time. So there's
right.
nothing common sense about race. The second part is that all groups are racialized, but we don't often see the shared connection. That was a big motivating part of writing the book. You know, growing up in Echo Park, being kids where kids don't really filter what they say,
mm-hmm.
and you have, you know, racial jokes going around. And even as a kid, I thought, why are Mexicans telling jokes about blacks? Why are the Asians telling jokes about Mexicans? Why is the Vietnamese kid teasing the Irish about, you know, and the Polish kid is the brunt of everyone's jokes?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're all sitting here in this very working class neighborhood that no one wants to enter because they think of it as the ghetto.
Right.
We have this great commonality to us, yet people have these divisions.
Mm-hmm.
Although, you know, in that kind of setting, it's joked around about. But as we know in lots of other settings, it's not. And so the idea about racial scripts is that we want to be able to see the connections between the groups
mm-hmm.
and see, you know what, that Immigration Act, it didn't affect just Mexicans. It affected Asians, and because of that, we have this common connection.
Right.
And then the last part, racial history, Chicano history, you always have to talk about agency and resistance. And,
mm-hmm.
Okay, even if there's a lot directed at you, what do you do in response to that? Do you send the president a letter? Do you start a campaign? Do you have a protest? What exactly do you do? And so I call those counter scripts. So just as racial scripts have a seeming persuasiveness, resistance also has a long fetch.
Right.
And so we see this in this counter script. And these can be daily expressions of compassion and solidarity. They could be big public protests. But they're, you know, main ways of showing resistance, showing solidarity with other groups.
Definitely. Thank you for that explanation. And you mentioned earlier, and you've mentioned a few times now, the landmark piece of immigration policy that was passed in 1924, which is where the book essentially begins, and that being the Johnson-Reed Immigration Act. And you mentioned how this key part of this legislation was this quota system. It more of, as my understanding is, I believe it tweaked it. It was initiated earlier, I think in 1921. You can correct me if I'm wrong. But it kept this quota system to where it drastically reduced the amount of immigrants coming from Southern and Eastern Europe. And then, as you mentioned as well, it pretty much flat out barred immigrants from any, you know, Asian, you know, territory, whether it be Japan or China or whatnot. Now, naturally, Mexicans, you also mentioned, were excluded or, you know, from this quota system. They weren't included in it. In fact, the whole Western Hemisphere escaped the quota restrictions. Yet, as you begin the book, you start to talk about how even with this exclusion of the Western Hemisphere, after around 1924 and shortly thereafter, particularly between the years of 1925 to 1930, Mexicans became the focal point of immigration debates. We discuss why that happened. Why is it that Mexicans became this central focus of immigration debates after 1924? And since you just explained, you know, the racial scripts concept, can you give us an example of some of the scripts that were used in these debates?
So this is one of these fascinating things. You know, I think for a lot of us that are interested in doing Chicano history, like Latino history, we could get frustrated in the ways that it was taught, especially at the K through 12 level. Usually that history is taught from East Coast. We barely ever get to the West Coast because the school year ends. If you went to school in California, you might in fourth grade have studied California history, but they don't exactly tell you how California came to be, and it was through the U.S. war with Mexico, in which the U.S. received a third of Mexico's land in the Treaty of Guadalupe that settled it. And so I bring this up because much of that earlier immigration legislation was made with an East Coast focus also. You know, we didn't have communication in the same ways. And so, you know, the largest point of entry at that point is Ellis Island. And so the immigrants that they're worried about are these European immigrants. They were sought after very much in the late 1800s and the early 1900s when the U.S. was at the peak of industrialization, building railroads, building factories, you know, needing those factory workers. And when that starts to slow down, people are concerned about the number of immigrants here. And they decide, you know, along because of these, also because of these cultural representations that already see immigrants like Irish, Italian in very negative ways, that it's time to restrict their immigration. But they aren't as concerned on the East Coast about Mexicans because they're not really thinking about them. But after that 1924 Immigration Act passes, people start to look around and say, hey, wait a minute. We put Italians on these immigration quotas, but not Mexicans. Mm-hmm. And they were very cognizant and vocal about that. We, as scholars today, call a racial hierarchy, that races are actually put like in a hierarchy in the U.S.
Right.
They were very cognizant that Mexicans would not be higher than Italians in that racial hierarchy. And so it didn't make sense to them. But even though there were people that tried to fight that, there were a lot of other groups that wanted to continue Mexican immigration, just like today, because they knew they needed their labor. There were agricultural leaders, railroad leaders.
Right.
This is 1920, you know, the late 1920s. The Imperial Valley, much of California has now been connected to irrigation systems.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we still think of California as the breadbasket of the nation, well, they needed people to work those crops, and they used all these analogies for Mexicans. They talked about them in biological ways. They talked about how they had the ability to do stoop labor. They talked about how they, because they were shorter and could squat easier, more easily. They talked about how they could withstand heat of 110 degrees, and the white man could not do that.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, these same stereotypes were used against Japanese just 10 years earlier when the Alien Land Law Act passed. And so, again, this is a racial script, but with a very different outcome. And that's why we always have to understand the context. And that's why it's not so easy to just call it a stereotype. So when they were debating Japanese immigrants and what their place would be in the 1910s in the U.S., they were, you know, many people, especially white farmers, were upset about how successful Japanese farmers were.
Right.
They could, you know, take acreage of land that was not very productive, but they could work it really hard and they could grow very labor-intensive crops. And so the discourse around them was that they had an unfair advantage over the white farmer because they could stoop labor, because they could squat, because they were closer to the ground, because they could subsist on rice, not meat. All of these same kind of stereotypes that they then used to let Mexicans continue immigrating were used to pass the Alien Land Law Acts in the 1910s against Asians, but in Southern California, that was very much against Japanese, that said that they couldn't own or they couldn't own land and they couldn't lease it for more than 3 years in a row.
Right. And with these, with the some of the other examples of the racial scripts that you use and how they can even compete in, against each other, coming from either a proponent of Mexican migration or an opponent, that they could actually, you know, contradict each other in ways. So first, one of the things that you mentioned is the comparisons. One of the racial scripts was a comparisons to slavery. That was driven by, you know, these nativists that were trying to curtail Mexican migration and stoke fears of either population explosion, miscegenation, right? So, you know, intermarriage and intersexual relations between the races, biological inferiority. And so that was used as a script by, again, nativists, but then those, say, that were tied to the industries that would benefit from Mexican labor used another racial script, that being the birds of passage. Could you talk a little bit about how these racial scripts can be used from, you know, both proponents or opponents of, you know, the side, various sides of these immigration debates?
Sure. So for slavery, you know, one thing to remember is that California is the hotbed of eugenics at this point in time. We often think of eugenics as something that happened, you know, in Nazi Germany, 1930s, something that happened over there, not here.
Mm-hmm.
But eugenics was a way of thinking about racial betterment, of how you could improve the nation. And so it wasn't this kind of like back room, dark conversation. People never revealed that they were eugenicists. It was seen as a progressive science for some at
right.
the time. And there were institutes in Pasadena, institutes at Stanford, you know, very prominent leaders in California, in Sacramento, who, you know, thought of themselves as eugenicists, or who also just espoused and you know, proposed their ideas. And so the same kinds of rhetoric that you saw around slavery were then used as a reason to say, hey, wait a minute, we need to be careful about who let into this country, meaning Mexican immigrants. And so they would often use examples from slavery. And look, you know, everybody thought that slavery was a good idea because it was cheap labor. But at the time that slavery, importing slaves was banned in the mid or early 1800s versus slavery being banned in 1865, and they pointed out that the number of slaves at that time versus the number of slaves in 1865, about 50 years earlier, had exploded, and that the same thing could happen for Mexicans. You know, ideas about intermarriage, you know, and what that could mean, not just for the people who intermarried, but the entire racial stock of the country. You know, it was this real, like, race baiting that would happen.
Mm-hmm.
And many proponents of Mexican immigration would argue, but, you know, slaves were brought here, and they didn't have a way to go back. Mexicans are in a very different situation. They are what they call birth of passage. They will come here, they will do the work, and they will leave. You know, it's a kind of unofficial guest worker program that they were advocating.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right.
And so they were, you know, they'll come here, they'll do the work, and they'll leave. But what and in the first place, that was never quite true. Camille Guerin Gonzalez talks about this in her book, that if you look at the numbers, there was always a number, you know, 20-25% of the population that was a permanent population that would stay, that was, you know, was of those people that would not return.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens after 1924 to show that they're not a permanent population is that people really start to focus, opponents really start to focus not just on men as laborers, but on their families.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the really persuasive ways of showing that Mexicans are a dangerous population is focusing on women and children.
Right.
These are people, and the headlines were, they bring their women and children too. And so they started focusing on birth rates.
Right.
And so here in the 1910s, when they wanted this labor, there were Americanization programs set up for Mexican families. Come learn English. Come learn how to cook American dishes. come to our public health clinics, and we want to make sure that you understand birthing techniques in case you have an at-home birth, and we want to make sure that you're connected to the local nurse, and we want to make sure that your children is receiving vaccines. But after 1924, it became the exact opposite. Now it was a concern that Mexican women were having too many children.
Right.
So birth rates had not changed. And so that's a really good example of that kind of cultural representation. Birth of passage is a cultural representation that makes the Mexican population seem innocuous. The women and children as a beaconed population is a cultural representation that makes them seem like a dangerous population.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the focus on women and children, and in your book, this seems to be a shift. And you, I don't know if this was actually the way it happened in the documents, but it seemed that after numerous attempts to try to limit Mexican migration through changes in immigration and naturalization policy, natives then directed, as you mentioned here, their attention towards women and children, particularly along the issue of birthright citizenship. And this occurred somewhat around, I believe, in the early 1930s. So in particular, non-white women and their children became the focus of legislative debates surrounding the transferability of birthright citizenship from mother to child. Will you discuss what you call in the book the long history of birthright citizenship and that debate? And in particular, you connect three seemingly disparate cases, that being the 14th Amendment, an important Supreme Court decision, the Wong Kim Ark decision, and then the Cable Act of 1922, and why it's essential to look at all three of those together when we're talking about this history of race-making and citizenship in the United States.
Sure. So during the Depression in the 1930s in the U.S., you know, as we all know, people were out of work, were very much suffering, but we also know through Chicano history that Mexicans became scapegoats for that, for those woes, for people being unemployed, especially in places in the Southwest. And so there became this move to return Mexicans to Mexico, and even those that had been born here, you know, many of them children. And so part of what comes up during that time as well in the 1930s is this debate about birthright citizenship. Now, the debate happens apart from the Depression discussion.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to set that up first because we need to remember that that's happening.
Right.
And so the debate is in response to this Cable Act that occurs in 1922. And it's this idea that women before had been, if they married white or American women, women with American citizenship, who married men who were non-citizens, lost their citizenship. How, you wonder? This seems crazy, but it's the idea of, you know, femme covert. It's, you know, the man is the head of the household. Just like she becomes a Mrs., you know, John Smith, she also takes on Mr. John Smith's citizenship.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is very problematic for American women who want to, you know, marry or are living in London and marry a British person, and they want to, and then if they get divorced or they just want to come back in the U.S., they'd like their citizenship. So the Cable Act repairs that. But what it doesn't deal with are a few other things that, you know, still need to be addressed. And one of them is that if that same American citizen, let's say again that Mrs. John Smith who marries a British national in London, let's say they have a child together while in London, and she knows that they're eventually going to come back and settle in the U.S., she's saying, you know, if I'm in London, I still want to be able to give my child my citizenship.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody thinks like, well, that makes sense. What's the big deal? And so there's this move to pass that. But what also happens is now we do have people on the West Coast, you know, probably learning from the lessons of the 1924 Immigration Act that they should be more vocal. And they say, wait a minute, we're not just talking about Mrs. John Smith. We're talking about Mrs. Juan Sanchez also,
mm-hmm.
that Mexican-American woman who married a Mexican man and lost her citizenship and is now living in Mexico. And what if she raised 10 children over there and then wants to bring them all back because you made them a citizen? Or what if we deported them and then, you know, it deported Mrs. Juan Sanchez and then wants to bring these children back? So again, they played on these same kinds of fears of this racial suicide. And so all that is very important to see how a discourse around immigration is working. But we also need to widen the lens to think back to how did birthright citizenship even happen?
Right.
This is something that not every country has.
Mm-hmm.
So what I go back and I try to do kind of a genealogy of that term, of that privilege, and show that birthright citizenship happens through the 14th Amendment after slavery is abolished. And people want are trying to figure out, well, now that slavery is abolished, are African Americans, are former slaves, are they going to be citizens? What happens?
Right.
And so they pass the 14th Amendment, which is, you know, directed at everybody who's black or white is supposed to be a citizen under it. So it deliberately, you know, is excluding Native Americans who they mm-hmm. know are living there. But then this test keeps getting, or this act keeps getting put, amendment keeps getting put to the test as different groups come to the U.S.
Right.
So Wong Kim Ark is one of these, you know, Chinese descent, but born in the U.S., goes back and visits China, and when he comes back is not allowed in because he's Chinese and Chinese aren't allowed to immigrate. And he says, wait a minute, I was born here. And they're like, yeah, but you're Chinese. Doesn't matter if you're born here. And so this becomes a case that goes to the Supreme Court. And so what I try to argue in the book is the ways in which birthright citizenship is made available to Mexicans is first because of the rights bestowed on African Americans, and then because of the ways in which other non-white groups, specifically in the Wong Kim Ark, help pry that door open just a little bit more for other groups. So oftentimes the rights that groups get aren't because they alone fought for them. It's an accumulation of different groups fighting for those same kinds of rights. And it's just another reason why we need to see the commonalities amongst these groups, why groups themselves need to see those commonalities so that they can work together rather than at odds with one another.
Definitely. And what I appreciate is how you, I think you even begin, I think it's your introduction, by showing still how relevant this history is. Yeah. You talk about the Obama birther issue, as to, you know, the challenges that Donald Trump posed against his citizenship, and as well as you connected that with the, more recent developments in, Arizona, after they passed their anti-immigrant legislation, SB 1070, where they tried to, again, attack the birthright citizenship provisions for children of Mexican immigrants. So these issues are still very much alive, and that's one of the themes that I appreciate that runs throughout the whole book. A lot of the issues that you touch on, all you need to do is flip on the news today, and you can see that these are still issues that are hotly debated and contested.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about that. I've been writing this piece, and I know we'll talk about this a little bit later, but since we're talking about it now, I'll just bring up this one part of it, which is, the Donald Trump story before he started running for president was that he was asking to see Obama's birth certificate, right? He was one of the main proponents of that Obama was not born in the U.S., that he was born. And this is a story that's kind of gone away now with his recent presidential bid. But of course, as we know, in his recent presidential bid, the first statement he made was about, you know, Mexicans being a burden to the U.S.,
mm-hmm.
about how they're not sending their best, they're not sending you, they're sending criminals.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of. The next day, after just receiving a storm of criticism, instead of backing down at all, you know, Trump doubles down and he says, oh, come on, you know, they are sending criminals and drug dealers, and they're sending disease. And as somebody who, you know, whose first book was on thinking about how science and medicine and public health have shaped our ideas about disease, that really gave me pause, because this is not, you know, after 1924 when we have these eugenicists trying to change the Immigration Act. It's not 1924 when people kind of either just didn't think about Mexicans or didn't think about them as dangerous as these European immigrants they'd put on quotas. By now, Mexicans in U.S. society are pretty much criminalized as illegal and drug dealers. And I thought, why do we still need this trope of diseased at this time?
Right.
You know, and part of it is that way in which we need to continue to have these internal borders, these social and cultural borders that the book has. You know, going back to 1848 when the U.S. annexes a third of Mexico's land, but especially between 1924 and 1965, the main body of the book looks at the time period, which what I call an immigration regime develops,
right,
where all these laws and stereotypes, cultural representations really accumulate to help build it. And yet here it is, 2015, and Trump is still using the same rhetoric. And so it's not surprising then, so a month later after this, he starts to call for the end of birthright citizenship.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been tracking this since I wrote the book. You know, I get Google alerts on birthright citizenship and different topics that I wrote about in the book, just because I'm interested, like you just said, we still open our newspaper and see this. And there are other terms that I even forget which Google alerts I put on, because I rarely get them. But I get a Google alert about birthright citizenship every day.
Mm-hmm.
Every day there's a newspaper, even if it's a small one in South Carolina or, you know, a local one in Florida, they are writing about birthright citizenship and are there ways to schedule it and is it fair to give it to everybody. This is something that is going to become a major issue in this presidential campaign.
Right. And in referring to this immigration regime, the book seems to split it in kind of two parts. There's the first part where these the 1920s, 1930s, a period I believe referred to as the long immigration debate era, where nativists. So, and that include, you know, right, legislators. It includes people in, you know, certain interest groups that are trying to promote their racial homogeneity or their vision of a racially homogenized United States, where they're striving to show that Mexicans are unfit or ineligible for citizenship primarily through legislative means and policy changes. Then in the 1940s and 1950s, there's another way that Mexicans are tried to be portrayed as unfit. And there's a new tool that seems to be developed. It's a tool that had existed before, that being deportation, but not as much relied on. And so, referring to two of the primary scripts that get used in this period, in this latter half of the immigration regime, the 1940s and 1950s, one you mentioned is concern over public health. And in the book, you refer to this as a type of medical racial profiling of Mexicans. And then the other is the, this terminology of wetback and undocumented and illegal, enters also the racial lexicon, of the United States. And so these two kind of terms are become more frequently associated with Mexican immigrants. Again, the concerns over public health, this sort of medical racial profiling, and then the issue of Mexicans being wetbacks and undocumented and illegal. So you mentioned that a third part of your focus on racial scripts is that there is a counterscript narrative that seeks to, you know, it's the agency part of the story, right? Where Mexicans, and not just Mexicans, but their allies, being them Japanese American or African American, other ethnic European Americans, that they present a counter narrative or a counterscript challenges, that is, to the sense that Mexicans are either wetbacks or that they are somehow, you know, diseased. Can you talk about some of those examples that you bring up a little bit later in the book? Like I said, in particular, what I'm thinking here is, some of the examples that refer more to the counterscripts that Mexican Americans and their allies start to produce during this time to, you know, fight these very, again, racist terminology that is continuing to emerge and evolve. But then it's also being coupled with immigration sweeps like Operation Wetback and things of that sort.
Sure. Yes, definitely that's that post-war period is just fascinating in terms of seeing how that category of Mexican evolved. You know, we need to remember that after the mid-1940s, Mexican Americans really became a more permanent and visible part of U.S. society. This is when there's a demographic shift. This is when there are more Mexican Americans than Mexican immigrants, especially in cities that have been receiving cities for immigration for a long time, like Los Angeles. And we often think about the civil rights struggles happening in the 1960s, but historians for a long time now have been pushing us to think about the long civil rights history and really pushing back to World War II and even to the Depression when people started joining unions and fighting for their rights in different ways. And so during World War II, you have Mexican-American World War II soldiers returning home, and like their African-American counterparts, they're demanding democracy and equality. I mean, Mexican-Americans are waging and winning civil rights battles, such as the precedent-setting Mendez versus Westminster school desegregation case, mm-hmm. and this predates Brown v. Board.
Right.
And so when Brown v. Board happens, it's those people that helped fight for Mendez versus Westminster that wrote letters of support. I'm blanking out on the legal term right now. Do you know what the legal term is? The Friends of the Court letter?
The amicus curiae.
Thank you. Right. Yes. And they write letters of support for Brown v. Board. You know, so they're doing all these things to fight for their rights. And it's just another example of, despite that, you know, all these assimilation narratives would have us believe that these groups, you know, once they're entrenched in mainstream society, that they'll become assimilated, they actually remain outsiders.
Mm-hmm.
And part two of the book is really trying to say that this narrative of Mexicans as not full citizens was continuously reinscribed and regenerated, just again showing how they would continue to be seen as outsiders and how terms like wetback would help define them in this new era. What I want to show through counterscripts was that they weren't alone now. You know, now with the populations growing, our ability as historians to get different kinds of sources by this time, sometimes it's a little bit, you know, harder to get sources that show things outside of the community, you know, not left by the community. And so one of the examples of counterscripts that I have is that it's during this period in 1954 that we have the Bracero program in the U.S., which runs from 1942 to 1954. It's a guest worker program. It's supposed to fill the labor shortages of World War II. But, you know, by the 50s, we're having a recession. This program has gone on longer than people thought.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also undocumented immigration that accompanies the documented immigration. And so people start, the government enacts a program to deport Mexicans. The undocumented population that stemmed from these changes, these demographic changes. And the focus to focus on is one that's actually called Operation Wetback. It's by the government, and it's called Operation Wetback. And it happens in Los Angeles. And it happens in a place that we all know very well. If you're from Los Angeles, you've mm-hmm. been there at Dodger Stadium,
right.
Before Dodger Stadium was built. And for people that study Chicano history, Latino history, they know that before Dodger Stadium was built, there was Chavez Ravine. There was a vibrant Mexican neighborhood there, mixed ethnic and racial neighborhood, you know, predominantly Mexican neighborhood there, that was promised public housing if they sold their homes, and they never received it because it was seen as a socialist experiment. So this is already a very contested space.
Right.
Operation Wetback happens. People are randed out of their homes, workplaces, bars. This is the other thing. It's like, oh, they're burdens to society. And one of the main places that they go to look for undocumented immigrants are at their workplaces.
Right, the job site, right.
And so they arrest them, they detain them, and they put them in these detention camps, these makeshift detention camps in Dodger Stadium, in Elysian Park, before Dodger Stadium is built. And in the newspaper accounts, there are groups like the Los Angeles Committee for the Protection of Foreign-Born,
mm-hmm.
who themselves are an interracial coalition. So it's not, you know, a Mexican advocacy group. It's made up of Unitarian ministers, you know, Black Baptists, Charlotta Bass, the African-American newspaper that hurt their editor and leader, Charlotta Bass, you know, their Jewish lawyers. I mean, just this incredibly generous multiracial coalition in the LA Committee of Protection for the Foreign-Born who are fighting for their rights, saying this is unfair, you know, you can't do this to people. And so they're protesting, and they protest at City Hall. They're writing in letters to the INS. They're setting up an office that's open 24 hours in East Los Angeles in case somebody's family member was taken away in the middle of the night. And that office becomes under surveillance. It comes under surveillance by the INS, and they start to track anybody that's even in a four-block radius of it. So, you know, you see just like how any activity to support immigrant rights are criminalized. And in one of these protests that happens, there's a group of African-American men out there, and they talk about how unfair these practices are. Mm-hmm. And, you know, is this fair to do to a group that has been here? Their land was theirs. And, you know, how can these immigration cops do this to them? And, you know, different things that they say like this, which are fascinating. What I try to show in my analysis of it is that those men often had a very similar history to those Mexican workers. You know, after slavery, there were a lot of, you know, African Americans come under guest worker programs in the same way, but they were put under these codes, these labor codes, where mm-hmm. if they were on a farm and they worked on a farm and didn't receive permission to leave that farm, they could be jailed, which basically meant that they would go back to the plantation where they had been working before, right. And it was now a prison, and they would farm that area, or they would be leased out to, you know, other farmers to do their work. They talk about immigration cops also kind of, you know, bringing up that contested relationship between communities of color mm-hmm. and the police. So there's lots of way, and just the fact that they were only a couple generations removed from slavery, from forced right. labor. So there's lots of, you know, connections that you start to see in community newspapers that people start making on their own that seem to invoke these racist scripts.
Right, and you also mentioned how some of the members of the Jewish community, which were also, you know, participating in this very multi-ethnic coalition, that being the LA Commission, again, for the protection of the foreign-born, how they too could draw connections, right, through that experience, seeing a, you know, makeshift type of detention camp thrown up in the middle of Los Angeles naturally could spark memories of, you know, their own family history and those experiences of, you know, discrimination and racial oppression. And in a place like Los Angeles, that ended up in this very multi-ethnic type of coalition where people could relate to that shared experience of racialization, and thereby this provided a window to one of those rare windows that we get in the historical record where a bunch of groups saw that commonality. And so I appreciate how your use of racial scripts is able to show both sides. It's able to show the process of racialization that is typically viewed as being enacted upon non-white groups, but then also this concept of counterscripts, and counterscripting is a term used to address the various ways that then that can be pushed back against, and that can be either be in forms of activism or other types of support. And so I think that's just an essential part of this story, and I appreciated it very much. We're coming towards our time limit here, but I want to talk perhaps wrap up our discussion talking about the usefulness of this concept of racial scripts today. And supposedly we've started to talk a bit about Obama a little while earlier, and the whole debate over his birth certificate. But again, Obama, as you mentioned this in the ending of the book, is used as kind of a symbol by, I think, a lot on the right to point to the fact that we live in a colorblind society, right? That we're in a post-racial period. We've elected a black president, and that thereby we don't need any type of affirmative type of policies that seek to rectify past wrongs, or even just acknowledge, you know, the existence of forms of institutional racism. So what is it that, you know, this discussion that we've been having in your book that brings out the historical process of, you know, relational race making how can our understanding of racial scripts help us to understand this contemporary situation? Again, where we're supposed to be beyond this this racial period.
I think one of the important things is just remembering that when we talk about racial scripts, you know, one big part of that definition is the structural part. You know, the laws, the policies, and those simply don't go away after, 1965 with even aggressive civil rights legislation. And as we know, much of that legislation, especially around the Voting Rights Act, is being rolled back. And so, you know, that part doesn't go away. There's right. the cultural representation parts that don't go away. With, you know, I mentioned the disease tropes that Trump talked about. So in response to those statements, I've been working on an article that says, you know, why, or, you know, I have different ways of approaching it, but one thing is, let me backtrack. So there's, with the Affordable Care Act, for example, Latinos were very, they were one of the lowest number groups. There were, of the different racialized groups that they tracked, Asians, Blacks, Whites, and Latinos, Latinos had the lowest participation rates in the Affordable Care Act. And people couldn't figure out, why is this? And so they went back and did studies, and you know, a lot of the newspaper coverage about it was, well, they might not, you know, and it's only for documented immigrants and citizens.
Right.
They're not talking about undocumented, but one of the things they said was maybe it's language. Maybe they don't know how to use the computer and the internet. And, you know, and it's just, again, it's kind of the colorblind argument. It completely ignores this whole history of the ways in which Mexicans have been racialized as disease carriers, as welfare cheats. Therefore, why would they want to go and sign up for a government program? It's the other part that surprised me is, you know, I read the paper every morning. And as I would be reading these articles, and I'm very old-fashioned, I still read the print edition. So as I was reading these articles about why aren't Latinos signing up for the Affordable Care Act, it would be next to these articles about Obama being the president who has deported more immigrants than anybody else, more than,
right.
than you know his Republican predecessor before. And so we need to see the ways in which all this scaffolding of race, all these laws, you know, those are in place, but also just the community memory of them is scary to people. It doesn't go away just because you say it's a colorblind society.
Right.
You know, and I think there are other ways in which we also see that the counterscripts around it, they are very empowering. So we can look at the Black Lives Matter campaign and the ways in which that was built very, you know, deliberately and effectively. And the ways in which, as other you know, communities have felt that they've been unfairly targeted, also then that kind of campaign. You know, Muslim lives matter, Latino lives matter.
Mm-hmm.
And people know what that means right away without it having to be built up in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And it's another example of the way that we can really benefit from those counterscripts today.
That's a great point, and particularly, you know, your emphasis on the institutional manifestations of racism and of the history of race in the United States. The analogy, I've heard you use it a few times, and you write it in the introduction to the book that you know, the institutional forms of racism form that scaffolding, as you say, upon which then cultures and ideas about race tend to form, is something that really appeals to me, and it rings true. I think particularly, it depends on your experience, but as you know, I drive through living in Los Angeles, or part of Los Angeles. I live up in Pasadena, if you will, and so I got to drive through the 110 freeway, right? And as I've been made that drive, oftentimes with either members of a family or colleagues or just other people, you tend to look along the 110 freeway and I start to thinking about the different types of development that you're able to see. And you can see as you cross into different communities and, of the change that you're going through in regards to class, right? And resources and a lot of my discussions in race with friends and colleagues, you know, issue around that, are centered around that desire to understand how is that? You know, how does that happen? How does one community, you know, seemingly surrounded by these other, either stand out as affluent or stand out as, you know, completely disinvested and falling apart. And it is those structural forces. And so that's a key part of this narrative and of your explanation of racial scripts, of how these ideas have, you know, evolved over time, but ring so true today, even our, in, you know, the supposed colorblind society that we live in. Things are different, yes, but the manifestations, you know, seem to, they are there just under the surface as to why many of these inequalities continue to exist. So I appreciate you bringing that out and taking the time to discuss with us, both your concept of racial scripts and the examples that you bring out the book. I think they're, of course, incredibly timely and very prescient to, the current debates that are going on. As I mentioned earlier, we're a little bit out of time pretty much, but I would like to give you a moment to talk a bit about any new work that you're doing. I'm not trying to put any pressure on you, push you into another work, but I'm sure you're working on something else. Could you talk a little bit about what that might be?
Sure. I'll tell you about one project because I'd love if anybody's listening to this and has anything to say about it, that I would love to be contacted about it, because it's actually a very different project than the kind of work that I've done before. Mm. It's a project about a neighborhood in Los Angeles called Echo Park, and I've written an article on it called "The Importance of Place and Placemakers in the Los Angeles Life of a Lot." Or I'm sorry, "The Importance of Placemakers in the Life of a Los Angeles Community," which gentrification erases from Echo Park,
mm-hmm.
and it's the exact reason that you just said. It was a perfect segue that, you know, we drive through Los Angeles and we think of some neighborhoods as hip and cute and trendy, and I want to go get, you know, a latte there. And right. Other neighborhoods as, ooh, those are ghetto, those are dangerous. Why don't those people clean up their street? And Echo Park was one of those neighborhoods for a time being, and now it's being gentrified.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, long-term residents have been priced out.
Right.
There's been entire apartment buildings where people have had to move. You know, they need to move very far. You know, lots of areas around there have been gentrified. But the article and, you know, the larger project, it's a book project that I'm working on now, is actually saying even before this time period where it was thought of as a ghetto, it was actually a really progressive place.
Right.
It was a very, you know, it has a long history. It was founded in the late 1800s, and it became kind of a haven for artists, for bohemian types, for gays, for white liberals, white communists, white progressives, immigrant groups. And they, you know, formed different kinds of institutions. They didn't open up just places that sold very expensive coffee. They also opened up law centers, bookstores that did readings, different kinds of nonprofit childcare. And, you know, the argument I make in the article is, you know, we have this argument about the possessive investment of whiteness that George Lipsitz makes, and the ways in which certain policies after World War II and after, you know, the establishment of the welfare state in the 1930s, especially around Federal Housing Administration and government subsidized loans, benefited whites. And they were able to move into the suburbs, and African Americans and others were not because of discrimination against them. So that, you know, some incredible number, like 98% of those loans went to whites.
Right.
But what you see in Echo Park was a lot of whites decided to stay and help these kinds of community institutions and grassroots institutions. And this went on from generation to generation. And I'm not trying to paint it as some kind of utopia, but there's definitely something unique there, something special there. And I'm trying to get at it through this large network of Mexican restaurants that I argue are urban institutions. They're forms of public space and in which ethnic entrepreneurs act as placemakers.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been kind of the museums, the history holders, the memory holders for these communities, and they're being erased now because of that gentrification. And so I want to see what made Echo Park such a special place. What were the ways in which we saw groups work together? How is looking at restaurants as urban institutions and forms of public space a lens to do this? And what are we missing if we don't have this conversation and we let gentrification continue without asking thinking, how will we continue this in this new phase of neighborhoods like Echo Park?
Right. Now, and that rings so close to home. I mentioned that drive down the 110. One of the things that we noticed recently in the past couple of years, my wife and I, was the just the proliferation of homeless encampments that you just can't miss anymore. It seems right now it looks a little bit better than it was a few months ago, but it was just astounding as we drove down the 110, how many homeless shelters were you know, temporary shelters were put up. And it just seemed to me, before, you know, I actually read an article that confirmed it in the LA Times, that it looked like communities were living there, and I was just blown away. And then I found this article in the LA Times, and it confirmed that, you know, this issue of gentrification had priced out long-term residents in the Highland Park area, and there were streets, I mean, portions of communities that did in fact move along the Arroyo, and they formed their own sense of, you know, community with these homeless encampments, and they were kind of, you know, policing their own little parts and not, you know, letting people into that little encampment if they weren't from a particular street or area. But that issue of gentrification is very real, you know, particularly in LA, and we see it happening a lot. So I very much look forward to that piece. And again, I encourage our listeners to get your book, to read it, and really contemplate its message, and again, the usefulness for looking at the history of race in America through a relational lens. So thank you again, Natalia, for your time. Appreciate it so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for tuning in to New Books in Latino Studies. I'm David James Gonzalez, the host of the channel, and I hope you have enjoyed my conversation with Natalia Molina, author of How Race is Made in America, Immigration, Citizenship, and the Historical Power of Racial Scripts, published by the University of California Press in 2014. I encourage you to get a copy of Professor Molina's book. You may do so by clicking on the Amazon link on our New Books in Latino Studies page. Also, if you'd like to contact us, please send us an email at newbooksinlatinostudies@gmail.com or comment and follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Thank you.